Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 243. It's Monday, January 22nd. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, let's start with the third in a series of reports from the Lucas County Community Health Assessment, a large survey of adults and youth. And this week, we're going to focus on the adult results for diabetes. So what do we have? Well, in Lucas County, the prevalence of diabetes is about 14%. That is 14% of Lucas County adults, or approximately 45,000 adults, have been diagnosed with diabetes. And that actually increases to 25% of those that are older than age 65. Almost two-fifths of adults, that is 39%, of those adults with diabetes rated their health as only fair or poor, indicating the impact of diabetes. Lucas County adults diagnosed with diabetes also were more likely to have the following conditions, such as being overweight or obese at 89%, high blood pressure at 75%, or high blood cholesterol at 62%. And this is often what they call metabolic syndrome, when you have a whole clustering of things where you get obesity and diabetes, blood lipid problems, blood pressure problems. Okay, well, diabetes is actually much worse in the Latino population in Lucas County. Compared to the 14% of Lucas County adults overall, Latinos have 19% prevalence of diabetes, which is approximately 7,000 Latino adults in Lucas County. And that increases up to about 49% of those Latinos older than age 65. And even more Latinos that have diabetes rate their health as fair or poor at almost half, 47%, compared to overall at 39%. And when you look down to how that affects our health in its worst case, which is mortality, if you look at age-adjusted mortality rates in Lucas County, that for diabetes, the death rate for diabetes is higher in Ohio and the U.S. I'm sorry, it's higher in Lucas County than in Ohio and the U.S. It's about 25% higher in Lucas County than the rate for Ohio, and over a third higher than the rate for diabetes deaths in the U.S. And unfortunately, the situation is worse for Latinos in Lucas County with diabetes. The death rates for Latinos in Lucas County are over twice as high. The death rate is over twice as high in Lucas County than Ohio, and it's about two-thirds higher than in the U.S. So there you go. Diabetes, we have a lot of room for improvement. We can do better in Lucas County. Stay tuned for more reports on the Lucas County Health Assessment in future episodes. Okay, well, let's turn our attention globally and get a global overview of the fight against tobacco-related deaths. This from Medical Express. Tobacco use shrinking despite industry efforts, says World Health Organization. The number of adult tobacco users is steadily dropping, the World Health Organization said, but warned that big tobacco was working hard to attract young people. In 2022, about 1 in 5 adults around the world were smokers or consumed other tobacco products, compared to 1 in every 3 in the year 2000, the UN Health Agency said. A fresh World Health Organization report looking at trends in the prevalence of tobacco use between 2000 and 2030 shows that 150 countries were successfully reducing tobacco use through regulation, high taxes, and other measures. But it cautioned that the tobacco industry was stepping up its efforts to circumvent and undermine that progress, including through systematic attempts to hook children with their highly addictive products. And unfortunately, nicotine is one of the most addictive substances on the planet. They're using, quote, what I would personally call criminal efforts, Rudiger Kreck, director of the WHO's Health Promotion Department, told reporters in Geneva. They are killing, and they're continuing to do everything possible to undermine the country's very good efforts. Currently, tobacco use is still estimated to kill more than 8 million people each year, including an estimated 1.3 million non-smokers who are exposed to secondhand smoke, the WHO statistics show. And the WHO warned that while smoking rates are declining, it will take decades for the number of tobacco-related deaths to follow suit. Though the number of smokers has steadily shrunk, the WHO said the world was set to miss its goal of a 30% drop in tobacco use between 2010 and 2025. Overall, the world is on track to shrink tobacco use by a quarter over the 15-year period to 2025, the report said. Good progress has been made in tobacco control in recent years, Kreck said in a statement, but there is no time for complacency. I'm astounded at the depths the tobacco industry will go to pursue profits at the expense of countless lives, he said. We see that the minute a government thinks they have won the fight against tobacco, the tobacco industry seizes the opportunity to manipulate health policies and sell their deadly products. Kreck pointed, for instance, to swelling industry efforts to infiltrate and influence national and international health regulation bodies and gatherings. He voiced concerns that such attempts appear to be ramping up ahead of the next meeting of the Global Framework Convention on Tobacco Control in Panama next month. He also highlighted the industry's promotion of e-cigarettes, vaping, and other smokeless products. While tobacco companies maintain they are not targeting young people, Kreck highlighted that their products come in thousands of flavors, and most of them are attracted to children, such as vanilla ice cream or gummy bears. E-cigarettes, which have enjoyed booming popularity among young people in a number of countries, are also found in the shape of the string of a hoodie, lipstick, and a pencil, he said. The WHO urged all countries to maintain and strengthen control policies and to fight, quote, tobacco industry interference. The report said that, on average, around 10% of 13 to 15-year-olds globally use one or more types of tobacco. So, tobacco remains the single largest preventable cause of death in the world, but progress is being made and the fight continues. Okay, well, next up, I want to get an interesting look at a new regulatory requirement that is very much limiting the amount of PFAS or forever chemicals in drinking water. A great case study, this from UnDark, the cost of freeing drinking water from forever chemicals. A tougher standard is expected early this year. That's when the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is set to finalize an enforceable cap on PFAS in drinking water that will require thousands of utilities around the country to update their treatment methods. The standard, which is in regular terms is called a maximum contaminant level, or MCL, limits permissible amounts of the two most studied and ubiquitous PFAS compounds, PFOA and PFOS, to just 4 parts per trillion in drinking water each. This is the lowest concentration that current analytical instruments can reliably detect, within specific limits of precision and accuracy during routine laboratory operating conditions, according to the EPA. 4 other PFAS, which along with a regulated chemical is sometimes referred to by the trade name GenX, will be regulated by combining their acceptable levels into a single value. Utilities will have 3 to 5 years to bring their systems into compliance. Agency officials estimate that between 3,400 and 6,300 water systems will be affected by the regulation, which is the EPA's first ever PFAS standard and the first minimum contaminant level set by the agency for any chemical in drinking water in over 25 years. PFOA and PFOS account for the majority of anticipated exceedances. Nationally, the price tag of meeting the standard could top $37 billion in upfront costs, in addition to $650 million in annual operating expenses, according to the American Water Works Association, a nonprofit lobbying group representing water utilities. That's far higher than the EPA's cost estimate of $777 million to $1.2 billion. And I would like to comment on that. So that's a huge discrepancy. But let's just take the lobby group's larger number, that $37 billion in upfront costs and the $650 million in annual operating expenses. That comes out to about $100 per person for those water systems, or for in the U.S., and that comes out to about $2 per year. So that sounds, you know, it's not an insubstantial amount of money, but considering the health threats, probably not crazy. Of course, the lobby group considers this a significant burden for an industry already contending with other costly priorities, such as boosting cybersecurity and, quote, replacing all those antiquated leaking big water pipes that transport the water from the treatment plant to the service line that connect to the homes, said Mark Edwards, a professor of civil and environmental engineering at Virginia Tech. In proposing the limits, EPA officials said they had leveraged the latest science to protect the public from PFAS pollution. Environmental groups welcome the move as long overdue, but the standard has drawn widespread criticism from the water utility industry and some scientists who say that in many places, small drops in PFAS water levels will matter little for exposure or health. They say there are other strategies that get us to safer public health protective approaches to PFAS that don't involve the really strict standard the EPA is putting forth. That was said by Ned Colon, an associate dean of public health practice at the Colorado School of Public Health and chair of a 2022 National Academies of Science report on PFAS exposure, testing, and clinical follow-up. A key issue, critic says, is that the standard ensnares too many utilities with very small PFAS exceedances. Roughly 98% of drinking water utilities in the country have maximum PFOA and PFOS levels below 10 parts per million. So it's the 4 to 10 parts per trillion. I'm sorry, per trillion, not million. So they're arguing that you should have 10 points per parts per trillion rather than the 4 that the finalized rule is coming out with. Okay, so all this is, of course, according to the lobby group. When the levels are already so low, further reductions of a few parts per trillion, quote, is not going to have much effect on total exposure intake. And that was purported by Ian Cousins, an environmental chemist in Stockholm University and one of the world's leading researchers in PFAS exposure, in an email to UNDARC. Drinking water is only one among many different pathways by which people can be exposed to PFAS. The chemicals are also in agricultural produce, fish, meat, outdoor soil, household dust, non-stick cookware, cosmetics, fast food wrappers, stain and water-resistant fabrics, and other products. Just how much these sources each contribute to PFAS exposure is a subject of ongoing research. But the EPA estimates that Americans get 80% of their PFAS intake from sources other than drinking water. And according to Cousins, dietary contributions likely account for most human exposure. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has required the phase-out of some PFAS in food packaging, but food is contaminated via bioaccumulation in agricultural and marine food chains, Cousins said. We cannot clean up our food in the same way that we can add a treatment process to our drinking water. So this is an interesting thing, is that, of course, the best way to deal with a PFAS problem is not keep pouring it into our environment in the first place. And since there aren't ways, it's very difficult to get PFAS out of the environment. We have ways to get it out of the water, but like the food system, the stuff that's already out in the environment being picked up by agriculture and accumulating in, meat, food chains, the higher up in the food chains, the more bioaccumulation you get. It kind of limits your ability to get at it. So I don't know if it's an argument to say that because most of it doesn't come through water, that you shouldn't deal with it with water, but it is important to note that water is only a relatively small proportion of the total PFAS exposure that we get. Okay, on with the article. In 2003, the U.S. CDC published sampling results suggesting that nearly all Americans had measurable amounts of PFAS in their blood. Published studies had by that time associated PFOA and PFOS with liver disease, reproductive problems, and cancer in laboratory animals. And one study at that time suggested a link between PFAS and human bladder cancer, but only among workers who were exposed at high levels on the job for at least 5 years. More recent evidence associates PFOA and PFOS with testicular and kidney cancers, and based on these results, the EPA now classifies both compounds as likely human carcinogens. Internal industry documents show that 3M, DuPont, and other manufacturers secretly knew decades ago that PFAS are toxic, but it wasn't until the 2000s that these companies voluntarily started pulling PFOA, PFOS, and other long-chain compounds off the market. By 2018, according to the CDC's most recent data, blood levels of PFOA and PFOS in the U.S. population had plummeted by 70 and 85% respectively. But that's not to say PFAS production ended. Companies merely substituted with different molecules, such as PFBS, like the BS in that, and GenX, called short-chain PFAS in part because they contain no more than 6 carbon atoms each. The thinking was that short-chain PFAS, still widely used in food wrappers, floor wax, paints, coatings, and many other products, were allegedly safer because they're more rapidly excreted from the body. Yet mounting evidence shows that they too are environmentally persistent and have toxic effects. Short-chain PFAS have been shown to cause thyroid and liver problems in animal studies, and recent evidence linked them to metabolic changes in isolated lab-grown human cells. Significant human exposures, Cousins said, come from short-chain PFAS contaminating the air and dust in homes. The chemicals are abundant in indoor environments, research shows, and the level in human blood rises with increasing exposure to household dust as well as drinking water. So this is really just an example of what I've talked about many times before about regrettable substitution. So as soon as you nail down something through scientific research as a health effect between a specific compound, they just start producing something in the same chemical family, which probably has similar biological effects. But this is a way to keep one step ahead of regulators and feign the fact that what they're doing is a move towards health. The EPA had set the 2022 values on the basis of evidence suggesting that PFAS and PFOA prevent diphtheria and tetanus vaccines from raising adequate immune response in children. In the agency's view, this immune system toxicity was the so-called critical effect, the first adverse effect that can be observed at the lowest tested dose, resulting from PFOA and PFOS exposure, explained Michael Dorson, a former EPA official who is also president and director of science at Toxicology Excellence for Risk Assessment, a nonprofit consulting firm that evaluates chemical hazards on behalf of industrial and government clients. Now the EPA is striking out in a different direction. Rather than basing the enforceable limits on immune effects, the agency instead derived the upcoming minimum contaminant levels with an eye largely towards protecting people from cancer. But the agency took a highly precautionary stance, one that in the case amounts to a cautious policy choice. Not the state of science, wrote Lynn Haber, a toxicologist and faculty member at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine, who specializes in assessment of cancer risk, and she said in an email to UnDark. Now, this, of course, brings up a huge issue in science. There's this notion that science is somehow objective, but even what we choose to research is a subjective choice, and something I've talked about as a major public health principle, the precautionary principle, is a subjective choice, a policy choice, a perspective or an attitude to take towards risk, which basically the precautionary principle is if you're introducing something new and untested to your environment, in this case for potentially toxic chemicals, is that you should show that they're safe prior to putting them out and using them. So that is what basically the EPA is doing, although obviously we have evidence after things have already been out. But now they're arguing, of course, that you haven't proved all the sets of chemicals, are dangerous. We've been down that road before. And the interesting thing about this, okay, so a lot of times those are arguments that focus in on one particular aspect, whereas, for instance, the precautionary principle is a very general kind of transcendent overriding principle that can be applied to our approach towards potential toxins. But when you look at the solution, while the new regulation is specifically for PFAS, the solution is using granular activated carbon, which captures the PFAS. Now, the thing is, granulated activated carbon will widely reduce a lot of toxicants in water. So there may be actually a lot of benefits. So this is the thing when you're looking, kind of making a cost-benefit ratio, if you're narrowing your look at it, you can argue about certain things, although I think the industry, you know, of course, is just trying to prevaricate about the risk and avoid having to, you know, change their industry practices. But this is a good point that this granulated activated carbon could actually reduce a lot of other harmful to health contaminants in water. So there's probably more bang for the buck. And the buck is not huge considering regulation and the importance of clean water in our lives. And of course, dealing with water systems for entire communities is a much better public health approach than trying to educate people, which usually ends up being an elite group of people who are probably less exposed to contaminants, to put in, you know, reverse osmosis systems and granulated activated carbon systems in their home. Why not deal with it right at the source and let everybody benefit, and particularly reach those who are at most risk and perhaps least able to deal with it on their own? Well, the next story gets at a large arc of stories that I've reported on over the years, that the U.S. has been in retrograde as far as health for going on about a decade here, whether that's, you know, not keeping ahead of chemical contaminants or inequities in the healthcare system or poor social determinants of, you know, racism and substandard housing, et cetera, et cetera. This next story drills down on one particular group, and that's women's health. This from The Hill. Women's health no better than at pandemic height. Women's health around the world is no better than it was at the height of the pandemic, according to a recently released survey. Across key measures, women are no better off today than they were in the first year of the survey, which was conducted at the height of the COVID-19 pandemic. The 2024 Hologic Global Women's Health Index report states, in some cases, their health is worse. Billions of women have physical or emotional health issues, aren't getting tested for deadly diseases, or are struggling to afford food, it added. The study found that in 2022, measures of health like reporting physical pain and negative emotions were no better than in previous years. More women reported experiencing anger for a lot of the previous day in 2022 at 25%, compared to 23% who said the same 2 years earlier. Negative emotions can become unhealthy and signal more serious conditions, such as anxiety and depressive disorders or other mental health diagnoses, the report said. The report highlighted data showing more women experiencing worrying for, quote, a lot of the previous day, increasing from 40% in 2020 to 42% in 2022. The percentage reporting physical pain increased from 30% to 34% during the same two-year period. More women also face hurdles, such as having problems with affording food, ticking up from 34% to 36%, according to the report. Hunger or undernourishment is also a leading risk factor for death and other negative outcomes, leading to 9 million deaths a year, more than the death toll from AIDS, malaria, and tuberculosis combined, the report said. The Hologic Global Women's Health Index surveyed more than 147,000 women and men from 143 countries and territories in 2022. Okay, well, next up, I have a story on inequities in health as well. This from the Kaiser Family Foundation Health News. Women and minorities bear the brunt of medical misdiagnosis. In a study published January 8th in JAMA Internal Medicine, researchers found that nearly 1 in 4 hospital patients who died or were transferred to intensive care had experienced a diagnostic error. Nearly 18% of misdiagnosed patients were harmed or died. In all, an estimated 795,000 patients a year die or are permanently disabled because of misdiagnosis, according to a study published in July in the British Medical Journal, Quality and Safety Periodical. Some patients are at higher risk than others. Women and racial and ethnic minorities are 20 to 30% more likely than white men to experience a misdiagnosis, said David Newman Toker, a professor of neurology at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and the lead author of the BMJ study. That's significant and inexcusable, he said. Researchers call misdiagnosis an urgent public health problem. The study found that rates of misdiagnosis range from 1.5% for heart attacks to 17.5% of strokes and 22.5% of lung cancers. Racial and gender disparities are widespread. Women and minority patients suffering from heart attacks are more likely than others to be discharged without diagnosis or treatment. Black people with depression are more likely than others to be misdiagnosed with schizophrenia. Minorities are less likely than whites to be diagnosed early with dementia, depriving them of opportunities to receive treatments that work best in the early stages of the disease. Misdiagnosis isn't new. Doctors have used autopsy studies to estimate the percentage of patients who died with undiagnosed diseases for more than a century. Although those studies show some improvement over time, life-threatening mistakes remain all too common, despite an array of sophisticated diagnostic tools, said Hardeep Singh, professor of Baylor College of Medicine, who studies ways to improve diagnosis. The vast majority of diagnoses can be made by getting to know the patient's story really well, asking follow-up questions, examining the patient, and ordering basic tests, said Singh, who is also a researcher at Houston's VA Medical Center. When talking to people who've been misdiagnosed, one of the things we hear over and over is, the doctor didn't listen to me. So a basic practice in the humanity of medicine is that listening to the patient, to their story and their complaints and their perceptions is very important in making a proper diagnosis. Racial disparities in misdiagnosis are sometimes explained by noting that minority patients are less likely to be insured than white patients and often lack access to high-quality hospitals. But the picture is much more complicated, said Monica Goyle, an emergency physician at Children's National Hospital in Washington, D.C., who has documented racial bias in children's healthcare. In a 2020 study, Goyle and her colleagues found that black kids with appendicitis were less likely than their white peers to be correctly diagnosed, even when both groups of patients visited the same hospital. Although few doctors deliberately discriminate against women or minorities, Goyle said, many are biased without realizing it. Racial bias is baked into our culture, Goyle said. It's important for all of us to start recognizing that. Demanding schedules, which prevent doctors from spending as much time with patients as they like, can contribute to diagnostic errors, said Karen Lufty Spencer, a professor of health and behavioral sciences at the University of Colorado, Denver. Doctors are more likely to make biased decisions when they are busy and overworked, Spencer said. There are some really smart, well-intentioned providers who are getting chewed up in a system that's very unforgiving. Doctors make better treatment decisions when they're more confident of a diagnosis, Spencer said. In an experiment, researchers asked doctors to view videos of actors pretending to be patients with heart disease or depression, making a diagnosis and recommend follow-up actions. Doctors felt far more certain diagnosing white men than black patients or younger women. If they were less certain, they were less likely to take actions such as ordering tests, Spencer said. If they were less certain, they might just wait to prescribe treatment. It's easy to see why doctors are more confident when diagnosing white men, Spencer said. For more than a century, medical textbooks have illustrated diseases with stereotypical images of white men. Only 4.5% of images in general medical textbooks feature patients with dark skin. That may help explain why patients with darker complexions are less likely to receive a timely diagnosis with conditions that affect the skin, from cancer to Lyme disease, which causes a red or pink rash in the early stages of infection. Black patients with Lyme disease are more likely to be diagnosed with more advanced disease, which can cause arthritis and damage the heart. Black people with melanoma are about 3 times as likely as whites to die within 5 years. The COVID-19 pandemic helped raise awareness that pulse oximeters, the fingertip devices used to measure a patient's pulse and oxygen levels, are less accurate for people with dark skin. The devices work by shining light through the skin. Their failures have delayed critical care for many black patients. So there you go, a long litany, how women and racial and ethnic minorities bear the brunt of medical misdiagnosis. And in a similar vein, this from Reuters, minority children in U.S. get poor healthcare, analysis finds. The quality of healthcare for minority children in the United States is universally worse than it is for white children, even after accounting for insurance coverage, an analysis of dozens of recent studies found. The pattern was similar across all medical specialties, including newborn care, emergency medicine, primary care, surgery, hospital care, endocrinology, mental health care, care for developmental disabilities, and palliative care, researchers said. Even after adjusting for the type of health insurance, family socioeconomic position, and other health conditions, the disparities were clear. Across multiple healthcare specialties, non-white children receive poor care relative to white children, said co-author Dr. Monique Jindal of the University of Illinois Chicago School of Medicine. These differences by race and ethnicity will persist without comprehensive changes in research, clinical practice, and policy, she said. The findings, which come from an analysis of more than 70 studies published between 2017 and 2022, were reported in the Lancet Child and Adolescent Health Journal. The strongest evidence of disparities was in pain management, with minority children less likely to receive painkillers in emergency departments for a broken limb, appendicitis, or migraine. Among children with diabetes, those from minority groups were less likely to be treated with an insulin pump and to have continuous glucose monitoring, even after controlling for insurance status, the researchers found. Minority children also received fewer x-rays for asthma, were more likely to have preventable and high-severity adverse events while hospitalized, and were less likely to have their developmental disabilities diagnosed before preschool or kindergarten. Structural racism underlies the differences, Jindal said. The impacts of housing, employment, health insurance, the criminal justice system, and immigration are impossible to disentangle and are cumulatively responsible for the poorer care of minority children, she said. Again, these are all large social determinants that require large changes in order to mitigate. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, next up, a story in a similar vein, this from Medical Express. Chronic inflammation and poverty are a double whammy for mortality risks, finds study. A new study finds that people with chronic inflammation living in poverty have more than double the risk of dying from heart disease and nearly triple the risk of dying from cancer within the next 15 years. The findings of the study are based on data representing 95 million Americans aged 40 and over. While chronic inflammation and poverty are each known to increase mortality risk, when combined, the two factors appear to have a synergistic effect, producing a greater increase in risk than if the individual effects of the two factors were merely added together, the study authors say. Their findings appear in the journal Frontiers in Medicine. So this is something I've talked about before, and it's one of the reasons so-called vulnerable populations are particularly vulnerable, is because most risk factors are not simply additive. When you add multiple risk factors together, you get this synergistic effect. So having, like I reported for Lucas County with diabetes, which often is represented by a metabolic syndrome where you have a cluster of things like poor blood lipids or cholesterol, high blood pressure, obesity. Together, these risk factors have more of an effect than simply just adding the individual risk factors together, that synergistic effect. Okay, on with the article. There is a lot of existing evidence that chronic inflammation can lead to disease, said lead author Arch Minas, a professor in the Department of Health Services Research, Management, and Policy at the University of Florida College of Public Health. We became interested in the potential interplay of chronic inflammation with poverty, which tends to increase inflammation on its own right through factors such as chronic stress. We found that poverty and high levels of inflammation act synergistically, giving people with both factors basically a double whammy. It makes them far more likely to die and in a relatively short period of time, just 15 years. Acute inflammation is part of the body's healthy short-term immune response to fighting infection, toxins, and other foreign substances that may enter the body. Chronic inflammation, however, lasts for months or years and has been shown to increase the risk for developing conditions such as cancer, heart disease, type 2 diabetes, and kidney disease. Another new study led by Manus indicates that 34.6% of the U.S. adults have systemic inflammation, so pretty widespread, over 1 in 3 U.S. adults. Chronic inflammation can be caused by a host of lifestyle, physiological, and environmental factors, such as poor diet, stress, lack of physical activity, smoking, aging, obesity, autoimmune disorders, and exposure to toxins in the environment. The findings from the study highlight the need for routine chronic inflammation screenings in vulnerable populations to limit what are, in many cases, preventable deaths. Currently, there are no clinical guidelines for chronic inflammation screening. Investigators have been studying chronic inflammation for 25 years, and we have a lot of data on its role in the disease pathway and mortality, Manus said. We know it's a problem, but we don't do anything about it. We need to translate the basic science on chronic inflammation to the doctor's office through the creation of screening guidelines so physicians can identify chronic inflammation in their patients and work to treat the underlying causes. Those individuals living with both chronic inflammation and poverty had 127% increased risk of dying from heart disease and 196% increased risk for dying from cancer. People living with chronic inflammation or poverty, but not both factors, had about a 50% increase in mortality risk over the same period. It's time to move beyond documenting the health problems that inflammation can cause to try to fix these problems. Of course, there's another reason, if you back into this in our healthcare system, why this doesn't happen, is that if you look at all those things that affect chronic inflammation, so they're largely the things that medicine, clinical medicine, doesn't deal with very well. We're not very well at dealing with people's stress, particularly stress that's socially induced, like racism or the stresses of poverty. We don't deal with poor diet. We don't really deal well in the clinical settings with lack of physical activity. Smoking, perhaps. Aging, obviously, is its own thing. Obesity, autoimmune disorders, and exposure to toxins in the environment. So you look down that list and you can see that we've got a lot of work, which is just another reason why public health is the big picture and clinical medicine is just one component of it. Okay, well, to drill down a little bit from kind of the big picture, let's take an example of some of this. This from The Hill. Drinking fruit juice tied to weight gain in new study. The consumption of 100% fruit juice was found to be correlated with weight gain in children, according to an analysis published Tuesday in JAMA Pediatrics, which analyzed 42 studies looking into the association between drinking fruit juice, the body mass index, and weight gain. It found that drinking 100% fruit juice was tied to a higher body mass index in children, as well as weight gain in adults. An 8-ounce serving of 100% fruit juice, or a typical glass, would contribute a larger proportion of daily energy in younger children than it would in older children. Our findings are in line with the American Academy of Pediatrics guidelines that younger children than 6 years should consume less than a glass of fruit juice per day. The researchers went on to recommend the delaying of the introduction of 100% fruit juice to young children, keeping an eye on serving sizes, and having children eat whole fruit instead. The research said an early introduction to fruit juice could lead to increased risk of being overweight and obese due to favoring sweeter foods. I think that's an interesting last thing there, that eating highly sweetened, refined juice, even if it's 100%, it really doesn't resemble the overall fruit nutritionally. It's even more sweet, and it's also easier just to chug down, a bunch of juice than it is to actually, eat an apple or whole fruit or whatever. But this is, just showing that the research links this with increased weight gain, and referencing to the previous story about inflammation, is partly not eating whole foods and eating highly refined foods, which of course 100% fruit juices actually do not resemble the whole fruits that they come from and should be considered highly processed, which can lead to inflammation in the body. Okay, well, let's switch to a couple healthcare stories that both accent the reality that more universal care is very good for the overall population health. This from USA Today. Cancer care improves in Medicaid expansion states. Cancer patients who have health insurance coverage fare better after a new diagnosis than those who are uninsured. A study published last week sought to measure how pivotal insurance coverage is for people with cancer. The study, led by the American Cancer Society, compared cancer patients in states that expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act with patients in states that did not expand. In states that expanded Medicaid, about 1 in 5 college or working age adults diagnosed with cancer were insured by Medicaid, the government health insurance program for low-income families and the disabled. Just 2% of cancer patients in these states were uninsured as of 2019, the last year included in the study. By comparison, 8.1% of cancer patients in non-expansion states were uninsured as of 2019. So if you compare that, the 2% to the 8%, you're 4 times more likely to not have health insurance if you're a cancer patient in a non-expansion state than the ones that expanded. The study said Medicaid expansion increased cancer screening and early diagnosis, provided better care for cancer patients, and decreased racial disparities among cancer patients. In short, expanding this health insurance program is saving lives. And this next story sort of flies into the face of people who are stuck on the notion that private ventures are always better than government ventures. This from Medical Express. Who is most efficient in healthcare? Study finds, perhaps surprisingly, it's the VA. Private sector hospitals, clinics, insurers are bloated, bureaucratic nightmares compared to efficiently run Veterans Health Administration facilities that put care over profits, a new study reveals. The study by researchers at Hunter College at the City University of New York, Harvard Medical School, and the Veterans Health Administration, and the University of Washington, points fingers at profit-driven private facilities and insurers, where a whopping 30% of staff are stuck in the tangled web of paperwork, while the Veterans Health Administration shines with a lean 22.5% administrative staff. That means nearly 900,000 fewer paper pushers would be needed if private hospitals, clinics, and insurers took a page from the VA's playbook. The research is published in the journal JAMA Network Open. Most of the bloat comes because profit-seeking insurers try to avoid paying for care by imposing complex rules and documentation requirements. Our profit-oriented system rewards providers for devoting more resources to gaming the payment system, said lead author Dr. Steffi Wohlhander. Private sector companies, providers, can increase profits by investing in administrative activities such as marketing and upcoding, that is, padding bills with irrelevant diagnoses that boost revenues but have no clinical value. This is not so at the Veterans Health Administration, where recent studies have found that care is better, on average, than that in the private sector. In the VA, caring for our patients, not money, is at the center of our mission, said Dr. Andrew Wilper, chief of staff at the Boise, Idaho VA, and associate professor of medicine at the University of Washington. We strive to care for those who have served in our nation's military and their families, caregivers, and survivors. The VA's 171 medical centers and 1,113 outpatient care sites care for about 9 million enrolled veterans. VA hospitals and clinics receive lump sum budgets covering almost their entire operations, similar to how fire departments are funded. Federal government's appropriations accounted for about 97% of the VA budget. Less than 3% is paid for by private insurers, and only 0.3% by patients themselves. Now, this is stunning enough, this research is, but this is just looking at the actual people employed in the healthcare setting, the actual, you know, hospitals or clinics. So this is compared to the health insurance companies. And of course, private health insurance companies are far, 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 far more bloated than the VA or Medicaid or Medicare that's run by the government. For instance, traditional Medicare's administrative expenses are on the order of 3%. It can be 20-30% in Medicare Advantage programs and other commercial nonprofit health insurers. This is about as good a reason as any, and there are many, to have universal health care.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has health care. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get healthcare whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without healthcare. Now, back to your community programming. Powered by community togetherness.
Okay, well, the U.S. healthcare system, we spend over $4 trillion a year. And whether to provide universal healthcare or not, and we've decidedly chosen not to do that, that's a strategic decision that has many costs, one way or the other. I'd like to end my regular reporting with just An article of contrast, so to speak. This from Reuters. WHO appeals for $1.5 billion to address crises from Gaza to Afghanistan. The World Health Organization on Monday appealed for $1.5 billion in funding to respond to the health needs of millions of people caught up in dozens of humanitarian crises around the globe, from Ukraine and Gaza to Afghanistan. We aim to reach some 87 million people with life-saving humanitarian assistance this year, said WHO Director General Tedros Ghebreyesus. To do this, we need support totaling $1.5 billion, and we need this funding to arrive as early as possible and with as much flexibility as possible. A reactive approach is not enough. Tedros said an estimated 166 million people would require health assistance around the world this year, including in the occupied Palestinian territories, Ukraine, Haiti, and Sudan. The health emergency requiring the most is taking place in the occupied Palestinian territories, and Gaza in particular, where Israeli forces have carried out a relentless assault against the enclave. WHO said it required $219 million to meet critical needs there for a period of 3 to 6 months, depending on the evolution of the conflict. The resurgence of cholera around the globe, which Tedros said was especially concerning, requires funding of nearly $50 million, while WHO's health response in Ukraine needs $77 million. The cost of inaction is one the world cannot afford, Tedros said. So, you know, this is something that I remember, you know, basically an entire wonderful public health dream of a response to COVID-19 back in the day, a couple years ago, for over a period of a couple years, would be about $50 billion. Which is, of course, a pittance compared to what Western states spent, you know, on their own populations. And, of course, when you're talking about pandemics, helping protect one another is also protecting ourselves. It's hardly simply an altruistic act. But the scale of the resources here is just stunning. So they're asking for $1.5 billion. Well, if you take just Gaza, the U.S. is asking for $14 billion just in military aid to blow the place up, when they're really just looking for, you know, a fraction of that amount for the World Health Organization to provide humanitarian aid to Gaza, provided that that aid is available, and even more so, whether it's possible to get the aid to the people and it's not blocked because of the conflict that Israel is controlling at this point, with the aid and complicity of the United States. Okay, well, that brings us to our final segment, Bonus Articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give the link again at the end of the list. 21 bonus articles this week. Number one. Diets rich in plant protein may help women stay healthy as they age. So this is basically just the benefits of eating a plant-based diet, which is both a positive thing for health and also a substitution effect, since a lot of animal-based products are actually bad for your health. Number two, an article that gets at one of my favorite foods is potatoes. Could potatoes lose their status as a vegetable? The debate has deep roots. So it's a kind of an interesting run of kind of the contours of such a story. The bottom line is that potatoes are good for you. It's how you eat them and what you eat them with that probably makes a difference. So most potatoes eaten, the vast majority of potatoes eaten in this country, are either as French fries or potato chips. And most of the remaining potatoes, even if you're eating like a simple baked potato, if it's got a lot of butter or sour cream on it, may take away from the wondrous nutritional benefits of potatoes as a whole food. Okay, bonus article three. Your body has a built-in system that works like weight loss meds, food, and your gut microbiome. So this is another great kind of story at, obviously, a lot of drugs try to mimic some of the body's own functioning, and these weight loss meds do that. And interestingly, the hormones in the gut microbiome changes that happen are actually things that happen with a whole food plant-based diet. And interestingly, when you do weight loss surgery, one of the things you're doing is you're making the stomach smaller or shortening the small intestine. And what this allows is undigested food to get into your down farther in your digestive tract, which is feeding the gut microbiome. It needs food, and our super highly processed diet doesn't leave much for our gut microbiome, so it has to get something. And of course, what it gets is also important, and a wide variety of whole plant-based foods is the best medicine. Another one kind of basic thing we can do for our health, a bonus article 4, at 93, he's as fit as a 40-year-old. His body offers a lesson on aging. The human body maintains the ability to adapt to exercise at any age, showing that it's never too late to start a fitness program. So this is a case study that was in a physiology journal about an Irish rower who didn't actually start rowing competitively until he was in his 70s. But now is very fit, so it's never too late to start. And there's one thing you can't put in a pill, just exercise. It's good for you in so many ways. Bonus article 5, what we're getting wrong about nutrition and mental health. Helping patients understand the connection and improve their diet can go a long way. So this is a psychiatrist's view, and it's basically lifting up the fact that nutrition, good nutrition actually has effect on our mental health and moods, but also our mental health can have an effect on our eating. If you're eating, for response to emotional distress or for comfort, it goes both directions. So kind of an interesting read there. Bonus article 6, the ideal vacation length for peak relaxation, according to experts. Spoiler alert, they're saying around 8 days, but it's a much longer read to get at the nuances of that. But I put that here just to show that, you know, taking time off and taking a little break, whether it's a week or a few minutes or an hour or a day, can be very good for our recreation as healthy beings. And in America, to show how diseased we are, we have much shorter paid time off than, say, they have in Europe. And most Americans don't even take all of their paid time off. Bonus article 7, how climate disasters hurt adolescents' mental health. So this is an example just of the trauma that can happen in climate disasters. Actually can emanate out, ripple out for days, weeks, months, years, even potentially generations. Bonus article 8, rising suicide rate among Hispanics worries community leaders. So suicide rates in the U.S. have been going up in the last decade, but it's going up faster among Hispanics. Part of this relates to sort of the trauma that's alluded to in the last bonus article there. And the fact that immigration status in this country can be a traumatic state of existence. Bonus article 9, after domestic abuse ends, the effects of brain injuries can persist. Again, trauma is not just present at the time of abuse, but if you're getting beat up and many women suffer brain injuries, that can persist and affect somebody's health and quality of life for many, many years to come. Bonus article 10, I'm not safe here. Schools ignore federal rules on restraint and seclusion. So this is about schools that often when they're restraining typically people with mental or emotional disabilities to either restrain them or put them in isolation or seclusion, they're supposed to report that to the feds, but there's a lot of places that do it that never report it. Interesting article. Bonus article 11. Researchers document health providers' impacts from post-Dobbs abortion bans. A good overview on the effect on providers and the trauma that they experience, moral injury by seeing the trauma that women are put through in the difficult situations they're put in with abortion bans. Bonus article 12, America's health system isn't ready for the surge of seniors with disabilities. Actually, our healthcare system is not ready for most people with disabilities, but as older folks are more likely to have disabilities, it's aggravated even more. Bonus article 13, MedPAC report on Medicare Advantage growth, high costs generates kerfuffle. First of all, I love any story that has kerfuffle in the title, but this is a government commission that reported on Medicare Advantage programs that are wanton use of upcoding and all this type of thing to generate more profit with no clinical benefit and the complaints that those profiteers have. Bonus article 14, data shows nursing home closure often linked to care issues, not just money. The story is actually related to 17 closures in Ohio over a course of a year. And it's actually often not just because they're running out of money and they're not getting paid enough for what they're doing, but because they provide crummy care. Bonus article 15. Employers are struggling to figure out if they're overpaying the healthcare for healthcare due to lack of transparency. Yep, the employers, the people that are paying billions and billions of dollars for healthcare, often don't even know what they're getting for it. 16. The truth about what health information exchanges can and cannot do, they have the potential to be an incredible tool, but fragmentation is endemic. So your health record doesn't necessarily follow you around because there's an estimated 89 different health information exchange systems that hospitals and health systems use. And even if you can get some of the information, you often can't get all of it. And that is not good. Bonus article 17. Could AI put clinical knowledge at risk? Relying on AI for basic tasks may undermine physician skill set. If you're interested in AI, this is a good example of where we may get an initial benefit by throwing all this stuff into a computer, but it may actually undermine basic skills that physicians and perhaps other professions have. Bonus article 18. Trump official who okayed drugs from Canada chairs company behind Florida's import plan, which is recently approved to import from Canada. Of course, Canada can solve the problem by government regulation. We don't do that. We just want to buy it from them. There's reasons why that won't work, but having conflicts of interest and corruption with a Trump official who approved this 2 months as the FDA secretary or a director, you know, 2 months before the end of the Trump official left office and then goes on to try to make money off of it. 19. How wealthy corporations use investment agreements to extract millions from developing countries through pseudo-governmental tribunals. This has been around for decades and can claw back public goods for private profit. Just when you thought nuclear might be going away, bonus article 20. First uranium mines to dig in the U.S. in 8 years begin operations near Grand Canyon. Well, nuclear is making a comeback, and uranium mines, as I've reported many times before, have a legacy of toxic problems, but it ain't over yet. Bonus article 21. To keep building materials out of landfills, cities are embracing deconstruction. About a third of the resource extraction from nature is used into building buildings, and about a third of the waste that goes into landfills is from destroying buildings. Maybe this is a good thing we can do. Some good news at the end. You can view these and all the other stories I reported on by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me. My second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some time.